persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please.
May it please the court.
Morning.
Morning. My name is Edward White. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiffs. With me at council table from far to near, my co-counsel James Henderson, Colby May, and Eric Zimmerman. I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal time. I'll be presenting the issues as this court requested: Commerce Clause, Tax Anti-Injunction Act. Unless there are any questions on our Religious Freedom Restoration Act claim, I will rely on our briefs for that. The district court reversibly erred here in ruling that the Commerce Clause authorizes Congress to compel American citizens to buy a product from a private company, here health insurance, for the rest of their lives, based upon their mental decision not to buy health insurance. Congress has limited enumerated powers. Because it has limited enumerated powers, American citizens derive some liberty because we know what Congress can and cannot do. In the 222 years since the ratification of our Constitution, Congress has never imposed a mandate on American citizens to buy a product from a private company. Any mandates that have been imposed by Congress have always been between the citizen and the government. You have to fill out a census. You have to show up for jury duty. You can be drafted. Never has it used this power. And why that is significant is, as the Supreme Court noted in the Prince decision, the fact that Congress did not use this attractive power is strong evidence that Congress knows it doesn't have that power. Congress has always used incentives. And what's interesting is that during all the crises in our country's history, Congress has used incentives. During World War II, you were not required to buy war bonds. You were encouraged. They put up posters, "Do your part, buy war bonds." You were not required to buy them. You were not required to work in factories. Even as recently as right about the same time as the health care law was passed, we had a crisis in the automobile industry. Congress did not require American citizens to buy a car. Congress did not pass a law saying if you go and you're over a certain income level to buy a car, there's no restrictions on you. They have to sell you the car. They have to give you financing. What Congress did was give us incentives, the Cash for Clunker program.
What about the idea that in the Supreme Court's case law, it is said that Congress can regulate conduct when it's part of, essential part of a larger regulatory scheme? Here, the larger regulatory scheme looked at least narrowly, includes the guaranteed issue and community rating provisions. And the guaranteed issue is not going to work without a mandate. So Congress has the power to impose the guaranteed issue requirement. Clearly, you agree with that.
Run that by me again.
Congress has the power to impose a guaranteed issue requirement on insurance companies.
Yes.
Okay, you agree with that. And then it won't work without an individual mandate attached to it. We know that from the states that have tried it that way. It didn't work. Massachusetts tried it with the mandate, and it's worked extremely well, at least in terms of the goal of coverage. So why doesn't that doctrine fit this situation?
Okay. That doctrine is fairly recent vintage. I think it was first talked about in 1995 in the Lopez case. It's only been applied in the Raich case. And what's significant about that is in Raich, it was an as-applied challenge where all the parties agreed that Congress had the power in the first instance for the Controlled Substance Act. And Congress had created a closed regulatory system that could not have any holes. Here, Congress has not created a closed regulatory system by its own language in the individual mandate, but giving so many exemptions to people who do not have to comply with the mandate. Congress has shown that it is truly isn't totally essential because they've exempted out various groups. So the what you have to always start with before you get to Congress's power to regulate Okay? Is this Congress have the power in the first instance? As the 11th Circuit recently held, as last week the Middle District of Pennsylvania held, is Congress doesn't have the power to make you buy a product?
Power in the first instance that I was posing is the power to impose on insurance companies the guaranteed issue requirement. Mm-hmm. I think everyone agrees that's perfectly constitutional within the commerce power. And then the question is whether this provision, which is linked necessarily to that, is permissible. And Justice Scalia's concurrence in Raich says the relevant question is whether the means chosen are reasonably adapted to the attainment of a legitimate end, and that Congress may regulate even non-economic local activity if that regulation is a necessary part of a more general regulation of interstate commerce. So again, the commerce regulation is the guaranteed issue. The link is the individual mandate. That's the question that the case law poses for me.
Right. And again, as the Raich majority said, what was pivotal in its decision was that it was an as-applied challenge, not a facial challenge. Okay. So they started from the premise that Congress had this power. What Justice Scalia is looking at there, and again, that's just a concurring decision, is that he wanted to make sure, because he assumed that Congress could close the door on illegal drug use across the board. And as a result of that, Congress is prohibiting activity. It's prohibiting you from your personal use, medicinal use based in California law. That's completely different than Congress requiring you as an American citizen to force you into economic activity here. That Congress has created its own problem by having the guaranteed issue, and I don't mean that that is a problem as people, it's guaranteed to have insurance, but as far as the financing cause of that, is what Congress is doing is saying, we are going to create a situation, and now that we said we've created the situation, we are now going to compel people against their will to participate in that situation. So, for example, with one of our clients, Edward Lee, faith, believes in faith healing, has not had insurance, has not gone to the doctor for over 20 some odd years, truly believes he has instructions to his family. If I have a heart attack, I get hit by a car, it doesn't matter. You pray for me. If God wants me to live, I will.
But counsel, you're raising a facial challenge, not an as-applied challenge.
Correct. And our point is...
So my question to you is, well, let me take a couple questions first. Looking at the language of the Constitution itself, do you see any principle that supports your position? The word is regulate, right?
Correct.
Regulate can be a requirement as well as a prohibition, can it?
Yes.
So the language of the Constitution doesn't support you, does it?
No, I think it does because it also uses the word commerce. Commerce is intercourse.
Well, it
is
be,
regulating
why
activity.
Why can't it be a requirement to engage in interstate commerce?
Because the line has been drawn by the Supreme Court.
Oh, no, I'm talking about the language of the Constitution
okay.
itself. And I don't see anything in the Constitution itself that supports you. Now we can go to the case law. But the language of the Constitution doesn't specifically support you one way. It doesn't address this one way or another. It does because it says you can, the Congress can pass laws regulating interstate commerce, and regulation could be a requirement to engage in commerce.
But you have to get to the part of commerce is what is being regulated there are people are voluntarily engaged in the stream of commerce. Congress, what is doing here is, unlike all these other Supreme Court cases we're looking at, or even cases from this circuit where we know there's been economic activity, okay, and that's what's being regulated. Here, they are regulating the status of being uninsured.
I understand your argument. I was just looking at whether the language of the Constitution itself supports you. Now, what about the facial challenge point? Judge Sutton on the Sixth Circuit went through that in great length. You would concede, would you not, that there are many people to which the mandate could apply constitutionally, even under your theory?
No, I don't concede.
Nobody? This can't apply to anyone legally?
No, because under the way the law is written now, you have a requirement where you have to have insurance for the rest of your life. You cannot opt out. In all of our history, people can come in and out. So, for example...
No, wait a minute. If Congress had passed the law simply requiring anybody who went to a hospital on an emergency room to, at that point, buy insurance, health insurance, Would you say that would be unconstitutional?
Yes, and here's why. I think what they would be able to do at that point is impose a tax, some form of a tax penalty, because the whole basis of our jurisprudence with regard to Commerce Clause is people can come in and out. It's one thing if you say, you show up to the doctor, you're treated, right, because they have to under MTELA, and we're going to have you sign up for insurance. Well, I can walk out the door and then say, I'm not having insurance anymore. I have that option. What Congress is saying here is once you're in, you're in. So it's, you know, the, you know, you can never get out. You can never check out of the hotel, right? You can check out, but you can never leave.
But then nonetheless, it satisfies your activity, inactivity dichotomy, because there is an activity. You're going to the hospital for emergency care, and the government requires you to buy insurance at that point.
Right, but what my activity would be there is what Congress is would be regulating is Congress is under the individual mandate is regulating the health insurance market, because under the individual mandate there's no requirement that I go to the doctor, there's no requirement that I even use the health care. Me going into the health care market, and then Congress is now imposing a lifetime burden upon me, I do not think Congress has that power, and that's held up by the recent 11th Circuit decision. And for example, you know, Judge Sutton went through and he gave some examples, but his examples always require a lifetime purchase of the product. So if you look at the Constitution, that's why we're saying an ultra-virus law. The Constitution says you're eligible to be president if you're a natural-born citizen, you're 35 and over. If Congress tomorrow passes a law that says anyone 18 and over could become president, and we bring a facial challenge, under Judge Sutton's view, is because there are still people 35 and over who are naturally born, the law applies
to
them.
He mentioned that doctrine, but he didn't rely on it because he went on for 25 other pages without analyzing that. And it was facial challenge wasn't part of the analysis in Lopez and Morrison.
Correct.
Right? Now, picking up on Judge Silverman's question about the text of the Constitution and then my earlier questions about the precedent. Suppose the text and the original understanding just doesn't tell us anything one way or another on this new kind of power. And suppose the precedent, I've read Filburn and Lopez and Raich and Morrison and Prince repeatedly, and suppose after that effort I come with no answer. Both sides pick out snippets that point in their direction, but the overall thrust of the cases really doesn't address this because it's a novel exercise of congressional power. How then should a court go about deciding the case?
Okay. I think you can rely on those four main decisions. The outer edge, which everyone will admit, of the Commerce Clause power is Raich and Wickard because it goes to intrastate local activity.
You're saying look at where the cases have gone and go no further.
Mm-hmm.
Another way to look at it would be courts should exercise restraint or be careful before infringing on new exercises of congressional power and let experimentation occur at the congressional level.
Correct.
Why do you choose that as the baseline versus, say, the restraint baseline?
Well, that was my second part, was the restraint, because I think as the Middle District of Pennsylvania noted just last week, the judge was bound by stare decisis. It's not just the outer reaches where you're looking at Wickard and Raich, which are basically the same case, even though it's a different substance. But you look at Lopez and Morrison.
That's not true. They're not really the same case. I think Wickard goes, forgive me for stopping you, but I think Wickard goes further. Wickard, if you read it carefully, applied in the following situation. You have a small farmer who wishes to grow wheat for the purpose of baking bread for his own family and only for his own family. And nevertheless, he can be barred from doing so. Now, in a sense, that is a greater exercise of governmental power than this case, because as Justice Jackson pointed out, the purpose of the statute was to force that farmer to buy wheat in the interstate market. He couldn't grow it himself, even to feed his own family.
I will address that after I address this first point, okay? Where when you look at Lopez, and when I say they're basically the same case, I think the Supreme Court and Raich said they're very similar circumstances, okay? And I understand there are nuances to everything. is that when you look at Lopez and Morrison, the court said, you know, the line is drawn between economic and non-economic activity. Here we have really the absence of commerce activity, and said you also have to consider the limits of federalism, because that's very part, because we are a country with a free market economy. We're not, you know, the Soviet Union with a centralized, controlled command economy, where the federal government tells us everything what to do. And especially when we go back to when you talk about Massachusetts, the states, and that's where people derive their liberty to, the states are supposed to be laboratories of experimentation. And if the situation in Massachusetts really seems to work over the course of time, other states can adopt that and can move on. Now, going to Wickard is more of a limitation. When we talked about Congress says, you were talking earlier about Congress can regulate and prohibit as they did. Wickard is a limitation in the sense of Filburn was still able to grow a percentage of his acreage of wheat.
That's only because there is an exemption for small farmers, but the logic of Jackson's opinion, it seems to me, made quite clear. He could have been barred from growing any wheat whatsoever.
Well, if
and to feed his own family.
Well,
forcing to buy in the interstate, in the open market.
But I do not think
it's a sort of a mandate, isn't it?
Well, not really. If anything, it's a limitation or a prohibition. If Congress said we're in effect going to outlaw wheat growing,
sort of reminds me of let them eat cake.
Well, and unfortunately, that might be where we're going if this, you know, if Congress has its unlimited power.
Wait, I'm not really understanding your answer to Judge Silberman. Okay. Justice Jackson is absolutely clear in saying that one of the things that was being asserted there is that this may force some farmers into the market to buy what they could provide for themselves, precisely this case. Okay. Had an alternative of a penalty, precisely this case. I don't know how you just, I mean, it was interesting to me that during your first 20 minutes, you steered clear of Filburn, for good reason, I guess, because I don't know how you distinguish it.
Well, the way I distinguish it is a couple of things. In keeping with all these Supreme Court cases, Mr. Filburn had the option to be a farmer and to grow wheat rather than soybean, and he then fell within this law that limited him with the amount of wheat he was supposed to be able to buy. There was nothing that my reading of the case saying he would never be able to
limit the amount of wheat he could grow.
To grow. Okay, but he was still able to do that. And he would have to make some choices, just as the people in Raich had to, even though their state law allowed them to have medicinal marijuana at the time, they had to make their own choices in that regard, whether to comply with whichever law.
And why I see Wickard as extending further than Raich, because in Wickard, the farmer is forced to buy in the interstate market.
I think he's only forced to buy if, under the circumstances,
if he wants to eat.
He's growing.
But he's growing 11 acres of wheat.
I know, but the logic of the opinion could have said he couldn't grow anything.
Right, and then that would be a blanket prohibition, just as you
that
have.
That would be perfectly okay.
But if Congress wanted to make the determination that wheat was the equivalent of marijuana and say we're going to outlaw the growing of wheat.
No, okay. But it was for the purpose of forcing him to buy in the interstate market or the market affecting interstate market.
So Congress would then be outlawing the growing of wheat, and he would have to be forced to buy that, and has put a prohibition outlawed that.
Isn't that quite extraordinary?
That is very extraordinary.
That's what Jackson said was perfectly legal.
Right. But that is not in keeping with...
You mean Wickard was wrongly decided?
Well,
you may be right about that.
Wickard would be the outer reaches.
Well, Raich endorses it.
Right. I'm not saying it was wrongly decided, but what I'm saying is that when you look at what Congress had done there, what they actually did was they did place limitations on the amount of wheat. He was a farmer. He voluntarily decided to be a farmer. He was involved in that. There was some controls over him, but it was not to the point, from my reading of the case, where he would never be able to grow any wheat and therefore would not be able to provide for himself.
I think that might have been the arguments. He had a business.
He did have a business. It's just like the man who ran the hotels and the barbecue places in the Deep South. They fell within the controls of Congress, and they either could get out of the business or they had to comply with, you know, serving all people.
Let me go back to a question
sure.
that the presiding judge asked. if there, you started out your argument, I thought, interestingly, by pointing out that there is no direct precedent for this situation. And Judge Kavanaugh, I ask you, well, even assuming there's no case on this and the Constitution doesn't give us guidance, aren't we bound to give a presumption to constitutionality to legislation of this kind?
You are, there is a presumption of constitutionality, but that presumption is undercut by the presumption of 222 years of history of Congress never using a power, and the indication there that Congress doesn't have that power. So, and we're making a plain showing here based upon the principles as adopted by several courts that Congress cannot force people into private commerce and to buy a product from a private company for the rest of their lives. All of our precedent, and if you go back even to the government relied on this at the district court, the the Militia Act of 1792. Congress just said you had to provide these, you know, show up with a gun and a bullet. You know, you could have bought it, you could have stolen it, you could have made it yourself. Even so, even 2-3 years after the Constitution, Congress is not telling people to buy products, and that also was under different enumerated power.
I think Judge Silberman's question focuses on, and your answers have focused on, two factors that I think point in different directions here that really are, for me, very important factors more than trying to get a snippet from a case here or there, which is, on the one hand, the history, the lack of precedent for this, and thus, as Justice Kennedy said in Lopez, his concurrence, potentially a major alteration of the federal-state balance. On the other hand, the notion that we all feel powerfully, that we're courts, judicial restraint, and it's a delicate act to declare an act of Congress unconstitutional. And in that latter regard, it seems to me we could be potentially in a situation where there's a shift going on in how the social safety nets provided in this country, a shift from before the 1930s, it was states and communities and families. In the 1930s, tax and spend government programs furthered in the 1960s. And now a different form, potentially, this could be the blueprint for a privatized social safety net with mandates on people to participate. So the government is not spending as much, the government's not taxing as much, but the government's forcing people to participate in private markets. 15, 20 years from now, there could be a lot of that going on, depending on the constitutionality and the policy judgments. But why should a court get in the middle of that and risk being another 1935 situation where you're in the middle of a change going on in how commerce is thought of in terms of the government?
Because the role of the court is to determine constitutionality of statutes. And here, as the 11th Circuit noticed, is that there's no judicially administered limiting principles here. The government could just point to uniqueness of a market, but that's more of a circumstance than judicially.
But taking my colleague's two questions, I think what they're not subtly, directly asking you is standard of review that we're looking at. Now, Raich, both the majority and Justice Scalia's concurrence, reading majority, we do not need to determine whether respondents' activities taken in the aggregate substantially affect interstate commerce, in fact, but only whether a rational basis exists for concluding so. I mean, that's what we're looking at here as federal judges. I don't know whether this is precisely a rational basis standard of review, but if it is, you're on a very difficult path. Justice Scalia said essentially the same thing in his concurring opinion, and if that's what our responsibility is, then it seems to me you got a hard way to go when you're looking at Raich and you're looking at Wickard, and rational basis or some form of rational basis review is what constrains us.
With regard to the rational basis review, and I'll go back to what I said before because I think it's critical, and the Supreme Court said it was pivotal, is that since Raich was an as-applied challenge, they were working under the assumption that Congress had the power in the first instance. And that's when you get to rational basis, because you've already said Congress can do this, now we're looking to see whether the means are rational here. But if you're, and it's kind of a blend in the necessary and proper clause there as well, even though it's an independent provision. But even if you go to most recently, just I guess it was about a year ago, the Comstock case, where it talks about the factors to consider when you're looking at necessary and proper, you have to look to the history of the federal involvement, the scope of the necessary and proper clause, the accommodation of state interests. Here we've talked about before, this wipes out the state interest because it can no longer be experimentation. The narrowness of scope, this is a radical change. This is not a modest addition to a federal statute.
Read the statute is preempting state statutes that would experiment in this area?
I think it's going to override that because there's no real incentive for the states because now states have more requirements.
Oh, none of, you're making a practical argument, not a legal argument.
Well, even if a legal argument, there'd be, legally, there'd be no real purpose for a state to experiment anymore because it's
still a practical argument. You're not arguing that the states are preempted by this statute, are you?
I don't know if they're preempted, but they're overridden to the point of that there wouldn't have
some
been
any statutes will be preempted.
Some
if,
statutes.
If the state statute says that you do not have, cannot be forced to purchase health insurance.
And thank you for that. And that.
That's true.
Is Idaho, Utah, Oklahoma, Virginia have statutes.
No, I was just, I thought you were making a occupy the field argument, and therefore states couldn't operate at all in this area. And I didn't, you're not making that argument.
No, no. It would override the interests of these particular states, as I laid out.
Now, but on the bigger picture question I asked you about the change in the social safety net, something you said earlier and maybe you want to elaborate on seems potentially responsive, which is the Congress can get at this same objective pretty well, if not exactly as well, through the tax code and incentives to purchase health insurance rather than mandates to purchase health insurance, right?
Most definitely.
But it's not going to be as, I think, during the process that led up to this bill, the public record reveals the health insurance companies were not satisfied with incentives because incentives don't work as well as a clear statutory mandate, a law. This is helpful for you on your tax argument, as you know.
Right. And I will turn to the tax argument in that regard. And Congress can use its tax power. So, for example, Congress, if it decided politically that, you know, it'd raise everyone's taxes a certain amount of money, and if you bought insurance, you got a tax credit. You know, they do that all the time. You know, if you buy an electric car.
Now, let me just think about this statute. And suppose, just for sake of a question, that it's $1,500, just for simplicity here. You would say a statute that says pay $1,500 to the IRS if you don't have health insurance, perfectly constitutional under the tax power. But if it says pay $1,500 or you shall maintain health insurance and pay $1,500 to the IRS or purchase health insurance if you don't want to pay the $1,500. That's unconstitutional. What's different about those two things? In other words, in the second one, you have an option, pay to the IRS or buy health insurance. In the first one, it's just pay to the IRS, and they're going to provide a government-provided medical benefit.
Because it's under the taxing power, and it's between you and the government. You're paying taxes just like you would on many things, and some people object to that, but you still pay it. That's a different premise than establishing the principle that Congress can require you as an American citizen, and when you're just at home, you're not involved in commerce, to buy a product from a private company for the rest of your life, whether you need it or not. Because
let's talk about a separate hypothetical. Mm-hmm. You say this statute, which in effect says you shall have health insurance, if not pay a penalty, again, let's say of $1,500, you say that's unconstitutional. A statute that says simply in the IRS code, if you don't have health insurance, you pay an assessment of $1,500. Under your theory, the latter is perfectly constitutional, and the former is not, and they seem extremely similar in terms of their actual effects on citizen behavior. Why should we have so much turn on such a minute difference in phrasing?
Well, I don't think it's minute just because of which enumerated power we're talking about.
We're talking about the tax power now.
Correct. Right.
Okay, so the tax power, if you don't have health insurance, you pay $1,500, just like if you contribute to charity, you get a break. If you have a mortgage interest, you get a break.
Right.
Okay, if you don't have health insurance, you pay a $1,500 assessment. That was what the House bill was. Everyone agrees that's perfectly constitutional. Perfectly constitutional. But you say it doesn't pass muster under the tax power if it says you shall maintain health insurance. And if you don't have it, you shall pay a penalty of $1,500. You know, it's very close, as the amicus brief, I think, of some of the professors pointed out, that is very close.
It may be close, but again, you're talking about a relationship between you and the government versus a relationship citizen to citizen. And if I'm paying my taxes to the government, and if somehow it's going to result in health insurance, I think that's a different situation than them putting me into the market to buy a product from a private company. And I think that's a critical decision, because if you just look at how Congress has always used the tax.
You think the average citizen would feel more coerced to buy health insurance by the first rather than the second? The first, again, was you shall have health insurance. If you don't, you pay a penalty of $1,500. The second was if you don't have health insurance, you pay an assessment of $1,500. So one citizen looks at the first and says, I have to get health insurance, and the other looks.
Well, I understand.
I don't know that there's a difference.
No, I understood you.
What the coercion comes from the money.
Right. No, but I also
raised it to $3,000 more.
But I understood your example was in the second example of buying the insurance. The insurance, who am I buying the insurance from?
Well, in the second example, it's just a tax code provision that says if you have health insurance, if you don't have health insurance, you pay an assessment of $1,500 on line 63 of your tax return.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right? That is 100% constitutional.
Okay.
That was the House bill.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference in the final bill, and it's slight, but maybe it makes a difference, maybe it's more coercive, is you shall have health insurance. If you do not, you shall pay a penalty of $1,500. And my question is there really a difference in the coercive power of the government over the individual between those two examples?
I think there is, and again, and it may be a subtle difference, but I think it's significant in that regard, is that when Congress is using its taxing power in this regard, okay, there's, again, the political accountability. People don't like taxes, so politicians are more attuned to how they're going to pass a law, and there is a backlash in that regard for taxes. When you're dealing with the Commerce Clause, because the Commerce Clause has been expanded from its original thinking, is if Congress has now used its Commerce Clause to have people buy products, then that power is more unlimited, because all Congress has to do is set up factual findings. So even in that most recent decision from the Middle District of Pennsylvania, the judge notes there, he asked the government attorney, if Congress accepted the principle an apple a day, you know, keeps the doctor a day, and had findings for that, can Congress require you to buy an apple every day? And the answer, there was no
Well, what do you mean by that? We're on the tax clause now, and the require
right.
word is the key word.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, if it's required by a $1,500 payment to the IRS, is that different from saying if you don't have an apple a day, you pay a tax of $1,500.
Have to make findings to support that tax code provision?
I couldn't hear you.
Congress have to make findings to support that tax code provision?
When it comes to the findings for a tax code provision, I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, then it seems to me it's easier. I'm not, your right. argument's not making sense. You're right. saying all they have to do on the commerce side is make findings and they're home free. On the tax side, they don't have to make findings.
Oh, no. What I'm saying is when we're talking about the limitations on this, we were talking about under the Commerce Clause power of them, Congress could, because they've been making findings, can make findings to anything and can make you buy anything you want from a private company. What would happen under the taxing power, if they do not have need the findings, that's a whole different provision, and it may result in the same end, but there's different implications there regarding political accountability.
That's what I'm trying to understand, your right. answer to Judge Kavanaugh, and it may be it's hard to find an answer, but I don't understand the difference. You're saying, well, the political accountability is different? How so?
Political accountability is different. Just why, for example, why this health care law right now is not a tax, why Congress went out of its way to call it a penalty, is because they know there's going to be more of a backlash from citizens, because no one likes their taxes raised. So they try to accomplish what they could have done under the taxing power, especially since the president said he was not going to raise anyone's taxes over
$200,000. Don't have to call it a tax. The license tax cases make clear there was a paid fee for a license, and the Supreme Court upheld it under the taxing power, even though the court assumed that Congress did not have the power to regulate that under the Commerce Clause, and even though it wasn't called a tax. So the label, what I'm trying to do is tease out what factors really matter.
Right.
And it seems to me the mandate versus encouragement is one line you've drawn. That has some force, I admit. And then another line you've drawn is the label, and I'm trying to tease out whether the label really matters. Suppose, for example, that this law enacted had a penalty of $50 if you didn't have health insurance. Called a penalty, $50. And then the next law called it a tax, and it was $2,000. Under your theory, the $50 one's unconstitutional. The $2,000 one is perfectly constitutional. And I'm trying to figure out what sense that makes in terms of the label.
Okay. With regard to these hypothetical statutes we're talking about, okay, whether they can do it under the tax power, we have to go back to what they actually did. And what they did was they passed a law under its Commerce Clause power. And Congress
did not disclaim the tax clause power, and they never said we're proceeding only under the Commerce Clause power. That's been repeated often, but it's not quite accurate.
When you look at the findings, Congress is only talking about its regulation of commerce, its ability to regulate commerce. Congress, when you look at the labels Congress used here, it's not just the labels of saying this is a tax, this is a penalty. It's what Congress did beyond that. Congress in this statute.
In the tax code, it's paid on your IRS form, it's assessed and collected in the same manner as subchapter B of chapter 68, which is the Internal Revenue Code. It's a big tax-related provision. Now, you still may have a good argument on the fact that it's a mandate versus encouragement. I think that's a fair point.
All right. If I may address the tax.
Sorry to interrupt.
That's your job. All right. When you look at this statute, okay, you have to look at the entire statute. If everyone complies with the mandate and buys health insurance, the government doesn't receive a penny because all your money is going to a private insurance company. When you look at what Congress did in this statute, Congress was very particular. Congress not only called it a penalty, Congress in other areas of the statute designated things taxes. So you had the 10% tax on tanning. You had the medical device tax. Congress also listed in the health care law 17 tax generating provisions. It did not list the individual mandate.
Something labeled a penalty can never be justified under the taxing power?
I don't think the label is not dispositive, but we're not just
that's
saying
that's what I'm getting at.
Right.
I'm trying to distinguish a non-punitive civil penalty, mouthful, from a tax that's justified under the taxing power. Mm-hmm. How do I tell the difference between those two things?
You have to look at the structure of the statute. You have to look at the language Congress uses. If in this case,
so you just said the language is not dispositive. So how? Okay.
Okay. You have to look at the purpose. Is it a tax revenue-eating statute? This statute, when you look at the...
Well, the Supreme Court's long said as long as it's revenue-raising, we don't get into that issue anymore, whether it's Sanchez or Szczynski or Bob Jones. There are a lot of cases.
Right, but the Supreme Court also says that there is a difference between a tax and a penalty. And a tax is to raise revenue, a penalty is to compel behavior. The penalty here, if you find the individual mandate...
Yes.
Okay. If in the LaFranca case, if you find the individual mandate unconstitutional, you never get to the penalty because the penalty is not standalone. The penalty is only triggered if people do not buy the health insurance. We're depending on, and in Congress, when you talked about this subchapter 68B, okay, Congress specifically put the health care law here under chapter 48. It also removed not 68 but 48. And even though it says it's assessed and collected as the same penalty, that doesn't mean that it is the same as a penalty under Chapter 68. And also, Congress, unlike all the other tax penalties, Congress removed the teeth here. You have a line without clause, without any teeth, because there's no levies, there's no criminal penalties. All Congress or all the government can do to assess this is to withhold some money if you have a refund, or come after you in a civil lawsuit.
Your view is 68, Chapter 68, deals with penalties for non-payment of taxes. That's the classic penalties that Chapter 68 deals with.
Correct.
It's not only those, though.
No, but those penalties are part of the taxing scheme, so to speak.
Right, exactly.
Here, this is something separate. And when Congress, again, when you look to see what Congress did here, Congress said, we're going to put the individual mandate in Chapter 48. There might be a cross-reference to 68, but at the same time, Congress is saying in Chapter 48, but we're not going to put any traditional enforcement penalties on this thing.
That makes it less like a penalty, less like a criminal punishment. I don't see how that helps at all.
We don't think this is a criminal punishment.
No, okay, it makes it less like a penalty. It's basically unenforceable except by a withholding or other mechanism by the IRS.
Mm-hmm. And it,
right?
That also, yes, all
not even
do,
the penalties that the IRS can usually impose on you are available here, so it's a lesser form of an IRS enforcement.
Right, which means to me it's less of a tax. Because if Congress wanted its money, okay, the last people you want to deal with is I'm a former federal prosecutor. The last people you want to deal with is the IRS when it comes to them getting their money from you. Okay? So all you have to do here is all they can do here is file a civil lawsuit. And it's going to get to the point where we have to make a judgment call. Is it going to cost us more money to get the $95 or not? But when you're talking, and my time's almost
up. We're going to keep going.
Okay. But when you tie
you'll get appropriate time for rebuttal regardless.
Okay, thank you. When you tie in the tax and the penalty aspect of it, when again, you have to look at what they did here. You have to look to see the different categories they put, different terms they use. So for example, the fact that they put the individual mandate in Chapter 48, which is the miscellaneous excise tax, there's a specific IRS provision code that says just because something is in the miscellaneous tax, it doesn't mean it's a tax.
But here's the problem, and I'm going to now blend into the Anti-Injunction Act argument, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the AIA, you said you don't want the IRS coming after you for your money. Congress has said we don't want citizens interfering with the IRS in their collection efforts,
mm-hmm.
rather pay and then bring refund suits. So the Anti-Injunction Act bars pre-enforcement suits to restrain the assessment or collection of any tax. Okay? Then in subchapter 60B of Chapter 68, where the penalties are all listed, it says that those penalties are assessable and collectible in the same and collected in the same manner as taxes, and goes on to say that the word tax in the title includes the penalties in that subchapter. So far, you're okay
mm-hmm.
on the Anti-Injunction Act. But the AIA applies to those Chapter 68 penalties, okay? Then we turn to this law. And you're right, it's in a different chapter, but it also says that the minimum essential coverage penalty shall be assessed and collected in the same manner as an assessable penalty under subchapter B of Chapter 68.
Okay?
Assessed and collected in the same manner as an assessable penalty under subchapter B of Chapter 68. Well, the penalties under subchapter B of Chapter 68 can be collected immediately. They're insulated from pre-enforcement suits. The penalties in this Affordable Care Act will be unable to be assessed and collected in the same way as penalties under subchapter B of Chapter 68 if they're not similarly insulated from pre-enforcement suits. So despite all this discussion about constitutional issues, I have a major concern that the Anti-Injunction Act prevents us from hearing this until 2015.
With regard to the Anti-Injunction Act, okay, as I said earlier, just because the penalty, which is in Chapter 48, says it will be assessed and collected as Chapter 68, Congress specifically took away all of the powers
okay.
in that
regard. I'm going to stop.
I'm getting okay.
Okay, you
right.
go ahead. You
okay.
go ahead. I'm interrupting too much. Go ahead.
And so we get to the point of the Anti-Injunction Act. The Anti-Injunction Act, by its plain language, deals with the assessment collection of a tax. Okay. In your typical Anti-Injunction Act case, you have a law that's in effect. The IRS has already issued you a notice of deficiency or has begun collection, investigation, withholding, and then you refuse to pay, and then you decide, I'm going to go to court now. So, like the Bailey versus George case from 100, almost 100 years ago. The timing here, in our particular circumstance, is you don't have a law that's in effect with regard to the individual mandate. There's been no assessment, no collection, no refusal on behalf of anyone to pay for this.
Your clients don't actually have to do anything until April 2015.
That's correct. Right. So it's only up until April, April 15, 2015. If they don't pay it, then, and they've already said in all of our papers, they're going to pay the penalty. Okay.
Right.
So the government does not, the purpose of the Anti-Injunction Act, going back to whenever it was in the 1800s or whenever it came in, the purpose was because Congress wanted the government to get its money and then we sort out the details later. Right? We don't want to thwart the government of its money to function. Here, we don't have those concerns. And again, as Bob Jones talks about, is that the Anti-Injunction Act deals with truly revenue-raising tax statutes.
This raises $4 billion a year. That's real money.
Well, only if everyone does not comply with the mandate.
The estimate from CBO is $4 million a year. Now, can you answer my question on if a Chapter 68, Subchapter B penalty is insulated from pre-enforcement review, how is it that this Affordable Care Act penalty can be assessed and collected in the same manner as that penalty if it's not similarly insulated from pre-enforcement review?
Because because
it won't be collected at the same time, so it's not in the same manner. How and when it's collected will be quite a bit different, and yet the statute says it has to be assessed and collected in the same manner as the Chapter 68 penalty.
But penalties in Chapter 68 have liens and levies and these enforcement mechanisms there. Just because...
Counsel, wouldn't this case be the same case if there were no penalty at all, if Congress had simply mandated it without a penalty?
Mandated the purchase of insurance?
Yes, said it would be against the law not to purchase the insurance without a penalty.
We would not be dealing with the Anti-Injunction Act.
No, that's right, but you'd still be in court, wouldn't you?
Would you have an
injury? You'd still be arguing that the mandate is illegal.
Yes.
Would you have an injury?
The injury would be...
You would have an injury because your client would be a judge be in violation of law.
Right.
And that would be an injury, and we so held, even if there's no penalty.
Correct. And again, when you look at the individual mandate now and the penalty...
Keep going.
Okay. It's not, and I think it was either in the government or maybe one of these amicus briefs or something talks about, it's kind of a choice, right? You know, you can either get the insurance or not. It's not phrased that way. It's just the same. If I'm driving down the highway, it says maximum speed 70 miles an hour. It doesn't say or, you just pay $300, okay? So it's working under the assumption that everyone is going to buy the insurance.
Right.
If people do buy the insurance, the penalty does not generate any income for the government.
I think that's a good argument, again, on your taxing power argument. I think that may be right. The factor we've teased out that's the
But the if you look strongest. At the Anti-Injunction Act, I know this became something important just, it's always been because of subject matter
it's
jurisdiction.
It's gotten underanalyzed because right. Neither side's been raising it.
Right. The government abandoned it a long time ago. But every court that, other than the Fourth Circuit, okay, every court that has looked at it, and if
Is
you look
there
at,
any case in which a court has held that a penalty that is not related to non-payment of taxes is covered by the Anti-Injunction Act?
Not that I'm aware of. I think
I'm not aware of it either.
I think any case that's dealing with a penalty where they say it falls under here is that the penalty is deemed part of the taxing scheme.
Right.
So, you know, I don't pay my income taxes.
There are
taxes.
Penalties in Chapter 68 that are not that way. I've looked at them all, and there are several that are not just for non-payment of
There's
taxes.
No case. There's
but
no case.
But no case that I'm aware of.
Those penalties, by definition, are covered by the AIA.
And
when statutory definition.
Okay. Again... When we say that a courts have not thoroughly looked at this issue, but I don't think that's wholly accurate. I think some courts have looked at it. For example, the Eastern District of Michigan just said, well, because there's no collection yet, it's not an issue. But if you look at Judge Vinson's decision in the Northern District of Florida, he spent the greater part of his decision, I don't remember how many pages, but it never ended, it seemed, of going through the distinctions of, and I don't mean that pejoratively, but it was very.
We take that as a compliment around here.
As a former law clerk, you know, I could appreciate how much time his staff and he put into it. But you know, he goes through and he goes through a very detailed analysis there. And even when you get to the question of whether it's a penalty or a tax there, he'll even sit there going to the timing situation, because the overall purpose of the Anti-Injunction Act is not being thwarted, because Congress, or I keep saying Congress, but the IRS is not being denied any money up until another 3.5 years or so.
What makes the Anti-Injunction Act particularly a focus for me as well is that Congress, in the Anti-Injunction Act and are related to it, a lot of other statutes, they've created exceptions to the Anti-Injunction Act. Indeed, after Bob Jones, when the Supreme Court held the Anti-Injunction Act barred that suit, Congress quickly responded with an exemption to the Anti-Injunction Act. They've created numerous other exemptions. And for laws like this that are high profile, Congress has also in the past created special judicial review provisions to ensure that the case is heard immediately, the Line Item Veto Act and campaign finance law. Didn't do that here either.
No, but that's addressed by, if I recall correctly, the dissenting judge in the Fourth Circuit, saying that just based upon, as I laid out, you know, how Congress set up this statute, it's a penalty, that Congress purposely put it outside the Anti-Injunction Act.
If it just called it a penalty and it was in Chapter 48, I'm with you. But the cross-reference assessed and collected in the same manner as penalties in subchapter B of Chapter 68, I think poses a problem, because those penalties are collected immediately, not insulated from are insulated from pre-enforcement judicial review.
But two statutes, and then I just want to talk about is Title 26. 6671 and then 6665, which the dissenting judge talks about in the Fourth Circuit. 6671 says, taxes imposed in this title shall be deemed to refer to penalties in this subchapter. Okay, the Anti-Injunction Act applies to such things, and they're dealing there with Chapter 68.
Right, so I think we both agree all Chapter 68 subchapter B penalties are covered by the Anti-Injunction Act.
But we are a chapter, again, it's important that Congress put it in Chapter 48, and that Congress removed all of these things.
Right.
And as Judge Silberman says, there are no cases that hold that just because it's a penalty, anything that dealt with a penalty was truly dealing with
the
tax. They
put it in Chapter 48, but they cross-referenced Chapter 68, which specifically refers to taxes. So it's kind of A equals B, B equals C. Congress didn't want to say that this equaled a tax, so what they said is this equals a Chapter 68 penalty. And when you go to Chapter 68, it says the Chapter 68 penalty is a tax for purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act. And if you put those things together, if it's A equals B and B equals C, well, A equals C, and this is barred by the Anti-Injunction Act.
Isn't there a last sentence which refers only to matters within this subchapter? In 68?
I don't have it in front of me, but I would think that it is critical. It is critical where Congress placed it. And if we go back to, you know, the basic principles of statutory construction, is Congress knows, we have to assume, again, the presumption, we have to assume Congress knows what it's using and which words it's using. And as a result, that they went out of their way to put this in a particular chapter, okay? And even though there is a cross-reference, the cross-reference does not mean what's a penalty in 48 is the equivalent of a tax in 68.
It may not be the equivalent for all purposes, but it has to be assessed and collected in the same manner.
Well,
in 68, it's collected without the interference of a pre-enforcement suit.
Counsel, why don't you focus on a sort of a separate question there? That let's assume, arguendo, that Judge Kavanaugh's proposition may be correct, that the assessment itself could not be collected, the penalty could not be collected could not be challenged in a pre-enforcement. Isn't your argument that the mandate is separate and it is challenged separately?
Right, because what I argued earlier is before you even get to the penalty, you have to address the mandate. Our challenge is to
that exact argument was rejected in Bob Jones, right? The school wanted to challenge the tax-exempt status, right? They said, we're not challenging the denied deduction. We're challenging our status. And the Supreme Court said you couldn't sever it out that way in that kind of suit, right?
But when you put Bob Jones into the equation, as with these other cases, you're still dealing with something where you have an enforceable statute. There's been an assessment, a collection, investigation, withholding is already taking place, and then there's a refusal to pay, and you go into court. Just based on the timing, we don't have that. Plus, you have to
You have no separate mandate.
And we have no separate mandate because
so the AIA does apply in 2014, but if you can get your suit in before then, it doesn't.
No, it won't apply because this penalty is not based upon the taxing scheme and the plain language, the literal language, as Bob Jones says.
Really onto the plain language of this, yeah. Assessed and collected in the same manner.
Right, but the plain language of the Anti-Injunctions Act says assessment collection of taxes. And this is not a tax based upon just by Congress putting it off the way it did.
Right.
And it is not the same as a 68 where they mean the same thing because those deal with the taxing scheme. This is a separate issue.
Not all of them. If you look through the entire subchapter B of Chapter 68, you'll see a wide variety of taxes that are imposed that aren't related just to non-payment of taxes. Tax penalties.
But those have been set. This one has been set aside, and the ones that, again, I don't have the statute in front of me. I would imagine those have something to do with your failure to pay a tax in the first instance, and the penalties again are applying to a tax. Where here, if everyone complies with the mandate, all the money goes to private insurance companies. It doesn't go to the government. Do you have any questions on?
Mr. White, yeah, much as I love the tax code, can I take you back for just a minute? I want to make sure I understand something that you said in our assessment of the Commerce Clause issue. Is Lopez, in your mind, a facial challenge?
Lopez was a facial challenge, yes, Your Honor.
You recall that the court stated the rational basis test there that Ray stated, and it goes back to Wickard. They're following the same line. Raich states that as the basis for our review, cites Lopez. Lopez cites Wickard. Wickard was certainly as applied, but that standard has been repeatedly stated by the court right up to today.
Okay.
Rational basis is what we're looking for.
Right, but when you look at Lopez and Morrison, okay, especially Morrison, because they had the mountain of findings that the harm to women caused all these problems that affect the economy, okay. They never get to the question of, is Congress have a rational basis in that regard?
But they're stating the standard. The first thing I want to do as a federal judge is understand what my constraints mm-hmm. are. And these three seminal cases, that's the way they stated it. Now, this is quite apart from Salerno, which you agree Salerno is applicable, that test, right? On a facial challenge, you have to show no set of circumstances exist which the act would be valid.
And I think in our case, there is no circumstance.
Not running from that.
No, because just like in Morrison and Lopez, they said that the law does not apply, therefore.
Yeah,
okay.
I mean, Morrison and Lopez also make it very clear there's no economic activity.
Right.
So, I mean, and that's what the later cases say about them.
Right.
Okay.
And for as you're concerned with the approach to it, you have to look at, you know, originally, what is Congress regulating? Is it economic activity here? Okay. And then you then go to these next steps of the rational basis, where even if you look at the findings, the first finding in the healthcare law, it says that the individual mandate, you know, directly affects the economy. Well, that's the regulation, okay? So we get to these rational basis considerations, but only after we get through the first hurdle does it have the power to impose this mandate on people.
What the court has said consistently, and this is where I'm not entirely understanding, I'm not asking for you to repeat again,
okay.
But I mean, just so you understand, concerned, the court has said consistently, where necessary to make a regulation of interstate commerce effective, and there's no doubt that the industry is in interstate commerce, Congress may regulate even those intrastate activities do not themselves substantially affect interstate commerce, and even if they're trivial.
Right, but those
use the word trivial several times in their cases.
And that's talking about the aggregate, where if you have Roscoe Filburn, he's growing just a small amount of wheat, you add up all the Roscoe and Filburns, it's going to have an impact there. But you still are going to have the economic activity. And you also have to look to see is, for example, in Raish, would that be a barrier? Would that be an obstruction to the regulation? But in our circumstance, the failure to have insurance, the decision to have insurance, is not obstructing Congress's regulation in the health care market. It's not obstructing Congress's regulation of the health insurance market.
Their findings.
I'm sorry.
That is you disagreeing with their findings on the impact of having a set of people who want to self-insure.
Right. Well, when you look at their findings, this court doesn't just stick
That's
with their
That's where
findings.
Rational basis comes in.
Correct.
In view.
But it's for the court to decide whether it has a substantial impact on the economy based on these findings. But also you have to consider, too, that Congress went out of its way to exempt a lot of people. And so that the individual mandate, you know, has exempted out various people. And really when it comes down to is when they're focusing on cost shifters, a lot of the cost shifters have already been exempted out. And really what it comes down to is the individual mandate is focused on young, healthy people for the most part to bring them into the system to compensate for these other requirements imposed by Congress. I reserve the rest of my time. Thank you. Unless there are any questions on the RFRA claim, I'll sit down now.
Thank you. We'll give you time for a rebuttal. Ms. Brinkman.
May it please the Court, Beth Brinkman on behalf of the government. I'll turn back now to the Commerce Clause and go through in the same order. The minimum coverage provision regulates the way participants in the healthcare market finance healthcare services. The provision regulates economic activity. It also forms part of the Act's broader regulation of interstate commerce.
Counsel, let's go right to what is your most difficult problem. What limiting principle do you articulate?
Certainly here, Your Honor, this is a regulation of economic activity. It's the means by which people finance their health care services. And it is using insurance, which is the customary means.
Counsel, you're telling me what this case, the facts of this case. But you know the difficult question for you is what kind of mandate could the government, could the Congress come up with under the Commerce Clause, which would be unconstitutional? What kind of requirement that persons buy services or products would be unconstitutional?
Well, certainly it would depend on the empirical
Just give me an example. Give me an example of a...
I think if we talk about the broccoli hypothetical, it would go to your question. I'm not...
You mean if Congress passed a law requiring people above a certain income to buy broccoli, well, that would be unconstitutional?
No, it depends, Your Honor. Let me just, if it were a, for example, if there were a...
Let me give you a General Motors example, because that was came up in the brief. Suppose Congress provided, because General Motors, let's suppose General Motors was close to bankruptcy again. Please God, that doesn't happen. But suppose it was close to bankruptcy, and Congress passed a law requiring everybody with an income over $500,000 to buy a General Motors product, let's say annually or every 3 years, it would get a tax, somebody buying that would get a tax credit and could sell it in the market. So they could end up economically uninjured. Would that be constitutional?
Well, the right analogy would be if
Counsel,
they were...
answer my question. Would that be constitutional?
I would have to know much more about the empirical findings, because what the
findings is General Motors is about to go bankrupt and we have to increase demand.
And normally in a market, a different type of market like that, there is a regulation on a transaction that has to do with the seller, for example. The problem in this market, which makes it look
Counsel,
different.
What about my hypothetical? Is it you are unwilling to give me any example of a mandate that would be unconstitutional? And that does then feeds into your opponent who say you have no limiting principle.
Far from it, Your Honor. Not at all. I think it's
Give
difficult.
Give me an example of something that would be unconstitutional.
How about mandatory retirement accounts replacing Social Security? President Bush proposed voluntary accounts to replace a portion of Social Security. If this law is upheld as constitutional, 5, 10, 20 years from now, you can easily see mandatory retirement accounts replacing Social Security. Constitutional?
It would depend, Your Honor. In that situation, the question would arise about what the empirical evidence about, is about the substantial effects on interstate commerce. For example, we learned from the Lopez and Morrison case that sets forth the limits.
The effects on interstate commerce are that people who are elderly, the government doesn't have enough to provide for their subsistence. And so to get people into the market earlier, force them to buy retirement accounts starting at age 25, is the rationale. And it seems to me that follows directly from this case, which goes into my question to Mr. White, that I think the government's theory would usher in authorization for a major privatization of the social safety net, with forced mandates replacing social and retirement accounts replacing Social Security. You could see the same thing with Medicare. I don't see how you distinguish those things. Now, maybe you'd say Congress won't do that, but that's not obviously something that we can rely on.
Those are fundamentally different. There is a limit. This is not a case that about there being no ability to mandate to buy a car or to have mandatory retirement accounts under our position. If we just
why.
Because what
I don't get the difference.
Because what is being regulated here is the customary means for financing.
Are you saying that the hypotheticals we gave you would be unconstitutional under your theory of the Commerce Clause?
Without knowing more, I would tend to think they would present very difficult issues. Just a bold mandate like that to buy a
unconstitutional
product.
You say they would be unconstitutional?
She didn't say that.
I can say that they certainly would be. I guess it would depend if there was some other crisis. For example, if there was a
there is a crisis in Social Security. Okay. There's a crisis in Medicare. Can the government replace those two programs with a system of forced mandates of insurance starting in your 20s so that the government isn't in the business anymore of essentially running out of money to fund those programs?
Our position here does not require that to be.
The problem is if your position is upheld 10 years from now, we're going to be here, and the attorney for the government's going to be saying, look, you upheld the mandate in that case, and that's no different from this.
But this is where we have in market participants being regulated because of two primary reasons here. There is a substantial effect on interstate commerce from their financing, from their economic activity, shifting tens of billions of dollars into the market. Insurance is the customary way to do that. People who do not use that means fail collectively.
People who do not save sufficiently for retirement are imposing a huge cost as well.
But here we don't have a kind of diffuse general claim about generic effects on national productivity, for example, which was really the issue and the problem in Lopez and Morrison. Here we are targeted on an interstate market, and I should also emphasize, as Your Honor pointed out in the initial questioning, that this is also essential to Congress's regulation, broader regulatory framework here with the guarantee issue and the community rating. And under the necessary and proper clause, certainly this is a valid regulation as part and parcel of that.
So one concern Judge Silberman identified about the limiting principle, and I think I share that concern. Another major concern I have identified to Mr. White, which is in 220 years, with a whole lot of laws and a lot of crises, Congress has never once mandated a purchase.
This is not mandating a purchase as a purchase and a product for its own sake. This is mandating a type of financing, quintessential economic behavior. And it is in a unique market. Congress, and I think that the conversations earlier about the standard here, this is an incredibly deferential standard to Congress, whether Congress had a rational basis.
Well,
to
that was an argument the government made in Morrison and Lopez, of course.
But this
and Justice Kennedy's concurrence goes through that and talks about the great restraint that courts need to show, but also that when the federal government seeks to alter the federal-state balance with something that is not linked to commerce, that the courts need to step in. And then you have Prince, which relies on the lack of history.
Your Honor, if we could step back for a moment and look at this regulatory scheme, it's evident it's quintessential economic regulation, and it's common ground that Congress could require insurance or penalize consumers at the point of purchase. What plaintiffs are attempting
counsel,
to do.
I thought there was common ground on that too, but counsel said no, that's not so. Because they could not require the purchase of insurance under circumstances where the purchaser had to keep the insurance for a lifetime.
There certainly is common ground amongst the courts, including the 11th Circuit's analysis.
There's not common ground.
Yes, Your Honor. But what they are attempting to do.
When you say it's common ground, you're usually referring to the parties
Correct,
in
Your
the
Honor.
Case.
But
I mean, you could say there's common ground with law professors, too, and that in 10 cents will get you on a trolley car.
But the theory here is that there could be regulation down the road, but it isn't how insurance works. You can't buy insurance on your way to the hospital. And here, where you have market participants, you have virtually universal participation, and in this particular market, you have businesses that have to provide care even to those who cannot afford it.
Could Congress impose prison time for those who do not purchase health insurance under the Commerce Clause?
I think there would be other constitutional problems with that.
Sometimes.
I'm not sure it would be a Commerce Clause problem.
It's not a Commerce Clause problem for Congress to authorize imprisonment for failure to purchase health insurance. I think that's got to be your answer in your Commerce Clause theory. But that alone shows the change that your position ushers in, because for 220 years, when Congress has wanted to encourage or discourage behavior, it's used the tax code, and it's done it through incentives that get you very close to a mandate, but not quite a mandate. Your Commerce Clause position means that it can be a mandate and that criminal penalties can be imposed, including prison time for failure to do the purchase. And that strikes me as a sea change in congressional power.
I don't think it necessarily means they can be imposed. It means that it's not the Commerce Clause issue. But, Your Honor, part and a significant aspect of what Congress was doing was including this as part of a broader regulatory scheme. And it looked at the experiences of the states, and it was clear that a minimum coverage provision is essential to the guarantee issue and community rating provision. That puts this well within Congress's authority to enact it as part of that broader regulatory scheme. And that scheme includes several aspects. It has various tax measures for employers, employees, it's expanded Medicaid, it set up state exchanges.
The only part, as I explored with Mr. White, that it's really directly linked to, as I see it, is the guaranteed issue provision. But the problem I have with that theory, I suppose, question about that theory, can Congress impose a huge requirement on an industry, a very burdensome requirement, and then, so that the industry doesn't crater, impose a mandate to force more people to purchase goods or services from people in that industry? The health insurance companies here said guaranteed issue without a mandate will be bankrupt. Use some of the states as examples of the problems. So,
will Congress certainly look at a just wealth of information about the crisis in the healthcare market and the cost shifting that comes about by those who attempt to insure? And I think that's evidence,
Your
Honor.
On cost shifting alone, that's the exact argument that Lopez and Morrison rejected.
Oh, no, Your Honor. That was a much more attenuated argument.
The idea there was that violent criminal conduct imposes a major cost on society that's borne by all of us, and therefore Congress can regulate that.
We are talking about a regulation of market participants in a particular health care market, and people who cannot guarantee they won't need those services, can't guarantee they won't buy, and yet are not paying it. There is no constitutional right to avoid insurance and have other people pay for your medical bills.
But isn't the critical assumption here that Congress made, whether you buy it or not, that all of us have health issues? I mean, that's the difference with all of these other hypotheticals. The consumers cannot be said, in most of these other hypotheticals, Everyone doesn't drive a car.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor, and that
Congress
means
said everyone has health issues. One where that was their critical assumption. That's how you tie up the requirement on the two sides. It's a regulated industry, and there are participants, and their assumption is everyone, whether they claim otherwise or not, everyone is involved. It's an entirely different picture than the other hypotheticals.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor, and I'd add another very unusual fact to that is that in this market, part of the issue is that providers have to pay, have to provide services to those who can't pay. And so this is regulating finance. It's very different from Lopez and Morris, and if I just can, Your Honor.
How about the old age? We're all hopefully going to get old.
Well, if you're talking about insurance for elder care or long-term...
Mandatory retirement accounts, which I think is the lurking, maybe not well much discussed, but for me it's the lurking next step in this kind of regulatory scheme.
What's different from that is, Your Honor, there isn't an identifiable interstate commercial market that we're talking about. We're talking about here about the healthcare market, and this is core...
Pension markets, not a... In the 401k market?
Well, so. Is there empirical evidence that some way that the financing is going to, you know, disrupt the market in a way? I mean,
I think actually Chile does use exactly the technique Judge Kavanaugh is describing.
Here, it is already a financing issue for services that are being obtained. And these are services for which other people in the market are paying for. That really is core impact, substantial direct impact. Unlike Lopez and Morrison, this is not some attenuated, perhaps ultimate impact on national productivity. This is on a specific particular market with participants in that market, in a market where there are market forces that have led to insurance being the typical way to pay. That is not typical of other markets. And it's because Congress and the deference that this court is due to what Congress is doing in its task to find a way to resolve that crisis is to take the customary means of insurance and require that as a means of financing for individuals who are participants in that market. And the presumption of constitutionality, the standard review that is given here, does make this a valid exercise of Congress.
I agree completely, especially with the last thing you said. That presumption of constitutionality is a key factor. And the great restraint that Justice Kennedy counseled in Lopez. But looking at it from a bigger picture than you were just saying, we have the history, never been done in 220 years. That alone is cause for judicial hesitation. The implications, despite your good efforts, I am very dubious that this can be cabined off as just a health insurance only precedent in any kind of remotely principled way. I know you have to keep fighting that. And then third, Congress has traditionally done this and still could do this so easily through the tax code. Indeed, the House bill did it. The House bill was 100% constitutional, and it could have all the same money in terms of the tax issue, all the same money payments, but it didn't have a mandate. It was, if you don't have the health insurance, you pay the money. And why would we potentially open a whole new avenue of Commerce Clause jurisprudence when there's Congress so readily could do this through its traditional tools, never needed this tool before?
Let me try it this way on two points. This is about insurance. Insurance as a means of financing. Now, insurance is generally linked to a transaction, a car purchase, but here, we can't do that because of the nature of the obligation to provide care even for people who can't pay at the point of purchase. So it is a means of financing current market participants in a market that is very far afield from the hypotheticals that you have posed, and there are limits, Your Honor. We look at Lopez, we look at Morrison, and I would urge that was
a... Lopez and Morrison are limits based on local or domestic law enforcement concerns, not economic concerns.
Well, also, Your
the
Honor...
The hypotheticals that both Judge Kavanaugh and I were thinking about are economic ones, in which there are mandates. And so, I haven't yet heard from you a principled line. Now, you might respond that the Supreme Court doesn't always look for principled lines, referring to the same justice that Judge Kavanaugh just referred to. I'm reminded of the Massey case, where it was held that it was unconstitutional for a state court judge to take campaign contributions of a certain size, but there is no limiting principle in the case. So you can, one argument you might make is the Supreme Court often decides constitutional questions without limiting principles. Would you make that argument?
Well, certainly, Your Honor. Here, I think that the fact is that there's this significant role that this minimum coverage provision plays in the broader regulatory scheme. I think there is clear Supreme Court precedent that puts this in the heartland of permissible Commerce Clause regulation.
Well, whatever this case is, it's hardly the heartland.
It's not the heartland.
It is in their rationale, Your Honor, of...
Now, if I were you, I would hammer harder on Wickard, because do you think I... this is a softball. Do you think I analyzed that correctly? And
I think both Wickard and Raich, Your Honor, certainly these...
Didn't you understand the distinction? And Wickard, after all, there's
yes.
An implicit requirement that the individual buy in the interstate market or the wheat in the outside market. So it could be thought of as very close to a mandate.
But in
that
this,
is not true in Gonzales, where there's an effort to try to prevent the individual from going into the market.
But this is an easier case because these participants are in the market already. That is why this is an easier case in those cases.
They're in the market already?
They are in the market for health care services. Congress, as long as they have a reasonable basis for classifying the group that is being regulated, Perez says this, Raich says this, do not have to excise out the idiosyncratic, the one exception, the few exceptions. And as a class, as an aggregate, these are market participants, and the choice of their means for financing what they are already getting doesn't work.
Well,
That
goes to the question, which market? You're conflating the market for health with the market for insurance for the health. And is that fair?
We're talking, yes, Your Honor. It is. There is a health care market and the insurance.
And the health care. But you're requiring people to go in the insurance market, not the health market.
We are requiring people who are currently in a market to finance it in a particular way. And that is an easier case than Wickard. And Raich really reinforces, again, the aspect of a broader regulatory scheme. Certainly there, the intrastate possession of marijuana was recognized to be part of the broader regulatory scheme that Congress had enacted to prohibit the interstate commerce in drugs.
The underlying conduct, I think they said in Lopez, for that doctrine has to be arise out of or be connected with a commercial transaction.
These are commercial transactions in the aggregate.
They will happen. What you're saying is that the commercial transaction will...
Are happening on a regular basis. In our brief, we set forth the...
No, but someone who doesn't have health insurance and doesn't get health care very often...
That's what's unique here, Your Honor. They may get it in 5 minutes when they get hit by a car. They may already have cancer that needs treatment. You know, the young and healthy is a misnomer. People are not even aware of diagnoses yet to be reached that they already have. I do think that it's important to remember here, Your Honor, under Congress's authority, the role that this does play in the broader regulatory scheme and the necessity that this, necessity of this to make the guaranteed issue and community rating work in an effective manner. I think I would move on to the tax issue, Your Honor. Okay. The minimum coverage provision is also independently authorized by Congress's taxing power. In light of your earlier questions, Judge Kavanaugh, I would just make quite clear that the difference in form here does not matter. The only consequence here...
Let me ask you this. Is it illegal not to have health insurance?
No. The only consequence...
Not?
The only consequence...
Specific mandate that says a covered person shall have health insurance. You're saying it's not illegal?
I think your suggestion would be who would have standing, who would be harmed
by
that.
Okay. Covered person shall have health insurance or pay a penalty of $1,500 if you do not.
It doesn't get...
Illegal. When you go on your FBI background investigation in 2018 and they say, have you done anything illegal, do you say... I didn't have health insurance.
Here, the only consequence is a tax consequence.
That's an important question, I think, to tease out whether this is a tax or not.
You know, counsel, I think it is illegal, and I think it's essential for your argument to make it that. Otherwise, you're going to run into trouble on the Anti-Injunction Act.
No, Your Honor.
Do you understand the dialogue that Judge Kavanaugh was having with counsel?
Yes.
Raising the question of whether the Anti-Injunction Act would deprive us of jurisdiction.
Yes.
And my response in part was that the mandate is an independent obligation on individuals without regard to the penalty. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, first I would just want to step back for a minute and talk about the difference of analysis between the constitutional tax power and the Anti-Injunction Act. I'm talking about constitutional, not statutory terminology,
okay,
which
well,
is very
different.
Okay, we'll
put aside the Anti-Injunction Act for a moment, because I think the order that...
Yes, we'll stick with the constitutional issue.
Stick with the constitutional. And on the constitutional issue, shouldn't we be influenced by what Congress said it was doing, and it made it clear it was not relying on the taxing authority? It may have been that it's sort of a... easy for them to have done it, but they didn't do it, did they?
I agree strongly with you, Your Honor. They did not
disagree.
Yes, I disagree with you. They did not
rely on the taxing authority.
They did not disclaim their taxing authority.
So did they rely on the taxing authority?
They relied on the taxing authority. The Senate did, for example, on a point of order. There is a House report.
In the statute, did they rely on the taxing authority? Yay or nay?
Yes, Your Honor, to rely on the taxing authority, Congress does not have to include a finding or a specific provision in the statute. What matters is the function. And here, Your Honor, they put it in the tax code.
Doesn't the President have a role in legislation? Didn't he sign this legislation?
Yes, Your Honor, and it was...
say over and over again he was not imposing a tax?
No, Your Honor, what the President said, there was no tax increase, to be specific, if we're referring to the same press account. But moving back to actually the political accountability, Your Honor, Congress put it in the tax code, and every April 15th, not just when it was enacted, every single year, every taxpayer is going to look at their form and know that this is from the tax power. So I don't think accountability
aren't you between a rock and a hard place? If you say you're relying on the tax authority, then aren't we going to get ourselves into a jurisdictional problem under the Anti-Injunction Act?
No, Your Honor. That is a question of statutory interpretation and the terminology. There's a very precise usage in the tax code. But before I went there, I wanted to say a couple other things about the tax power here. The use of the tax power here is very consistent with both other provisions of the Affordable Care Act and with Congress's longstanding use of the tax code to promote the use of health care insurance to finance health care services. For ages on your income as an employee, the premiums that your employer pays are not counted as part of your income. At the same time, the employer can deduct as a business deduction the premiums that he pays for your health insurance. In addition, in the Affordable Care Act, there are several tax measures that are part of this regulatory framework. There are tax incentives for small employers. There are tax credits for middle-income people to help pay for premiums. Just like a tax credit, we have here a tax penalty. That is well. That is
the distinction is the mandate. When it's accompanied by a mandate or prohibition, that is not ordinarily referred to as a tax. I think the Texas amicus brief pointed out, as the SG argued in the child labor tax cases in trying to distinguish a tax from a penalty, said that the statute prohibits the doing of an act, and as a sanction imposes a pecuniary punishment for violating the act, then it is a penalty and not a tax at all.
Well, Your Honor,
so
I think that
the standard of conduct, if it's encouraging or discouraging, in other words, pay the money if you engage in the behavior or don't engage in the behavior, that's taxes usually. If it's, it is unlawful to engage in the behavior, and here's the penalty, that's not usually considered a tax. In fact, I can't find it ever being considered a tax for purposes of the tax power.
Well, I'd like to make 3 points, Your Honor. As Your Honor already mentioned, Bob Jones made clear that the Supreme Court is no longer in the business of determining, you know, revenue versus regulatory provisions. I'd also bring the court
with you on that.
Yeah. I'd bring the court's attention to the New York versus United States, which we gave an example where there is a requirement. There was a requirement on states.
States, I guess, was the difference. I agree.
I don't think that's a different at all. They were there as a taxpayer. They were challenging that provision.
A helpful case for you. I agree.
Yeah, and the court said we're not going to pry this apart. And it said you have a statutory obligation. Judge Silberman, going to your question there, it said statutory obligation, and if you don't do it part of, under this complicated process, there's going to be a part of a surcharge. And that was nonetheless upheld as under the Congress's taxing authority.
Could Congress, after Lopez, ban possession of guns near schools and impose a civil penalty?
That becomes more difficult because of the questions about, particularly under the lines of
a cases, non-punitive civil penalty.
I think the question would be the punitive aspect of it, because certainly
no, it's non-punitive under the Kurth Ranch test. It's a non-punitive civil penalty.
But I think you're begging the question, Your Honor, that it's non-punitive under the Kurth Ranch, because one of the questions is whether or not it's imposed on criminal conduct.
No, it's not criminal at all. They don't impose prison time at all, assume in my hypothetical. So after Lopez, it's just a new statute that says it shall be unlawful to possess a gun near a school. The penalty for this is a non-punitive civil penalty of $1,000. Constitutional or not?
If it did not...
Under the taxing power.
Under the tax power. If it did not create the issues, I mean, we're taken to account a lot under Mendoza-Martinez, and that what you look there to see if it causes double jeopardy problems, that type of thing. I mean, if all of those are included within your hypothetical, I think there may not be a problem.
Right. So then I think that's your position, actually. And I think your position is that all non-punitive, under the Kurth Ranch test, all non-punitive civil penalties can be justified under the tax power.
Well, not necessarily. There has to be some incidence on which the tax falls. And here it is, the financing of health care without insurance and the consequences.
There has to be behavior on which the penalty is imposed, sure. But I'm not aware of precedent that necessarily supports that theory of the taxing power to basically allow punitive civil penalties on all these things that Congress couldn't reach through the commerce power.
Well, here the only consequence is tax liability. This is not like the child labor cases where there's some other, you know, enforcement mechanism outside
law,
of the IRS.
If the same law were passed and it was a civil penalty and it was enforced by the U.S. attorney, civil penalty, same exact penalties called a penalty, still justified under the tax power?
Well, you'd have to step back, I think, and look through the analysis and whether it was functioning as a tax. And we've gone through several of the reasons why this functions as a tax. For example, payment, and Judge Silberman, I think this goes to your original question, too, the payment of the tax eliminates any requirement under the minimum coverage provision. It's not as if you're robbing someone. If you're robbing, you're punished for that, but you get to keep what you stole. There's here, it eliminates the underlying requirement.
So there
it
is also, there's no moral or legal obligation on somebody to buy insurance under this statute.
The only consequence is the tax penalty.
That's not my question. If there's no obligation, legal obligation, to buy insurance.
No more than there was on the states in New York versus United States, where the Supreme Court talked about the statutory obligation that was imposed there, but realized and said this cannot be divorced from the other aspects of this, one of them being a surcharge that was upheld under the tax authority, and that was a requirement, that was a obligation.
Just so I'm clear, and I touched on this earlier, but are you aware of a precedent where conduct is made illegal and sanctioned by a monetary exaction, and that's been justified under the taxing power?
Well, certainly in the Sanchez case, for example,
conduct wasn't made illegal. There was a tax on the transfer.
But there was a requirement that you get a license,
yes,
and pay that special
and in the
tax.
License tax cases, but once
and that was one. No, this was in the Sanchez case.
I know, both of them.
And you pay $1 per ounce, and if you don't do that, then you pay $100 per ounce requirement tax. That was upheld as a tax.
Here's a potential distinction that I'd like you to respond, which is once you pay the fee for a license, you are acting lawfully in selling the lottery tickets, in selling the liquor in the license test cases, in selling the marijuana in Sanchez once you get the license. Here, although your answer has been a little different, as I understand it, once you've paid the tax, you're still acting unlawfully because you have to pay you're incurring and continuing tax liability each month.
But you're just paying the tax for the period in which you do not maintain the minimum requirement, and it is month by month. And if
so
you have
a
partial coverage during the month, it is prorated according to the months in that year.
And this, I think this is a close call. You're equating it to a license to not have health insurance.
Nah. I want to pull it back to this idea that it's like a
that's a
tax
that was a
credit.
Helpful question.
Yeah, but I also, you know, you have tax credits, you have tax penalties. This is part of the consequence is the bottom line of your taxes, and that's what can support as an independent basis congressional authority to enact this.
If we thought you were right on both grounds, the court thought you were right on both grounds, the taxing power is far narrower, correct? Because all you could do is impose monetary exactions. The Commerce Clause theory would allow you to impose prison time on people who didn't comply with the mandate in future statutes, correct?
Well, I hesitate to say it would allow it because there are other constitutional limitations, but I think under that view it could be viewed as a narrower ground.
Well, you could impose a prison time for failure to pay the taxes.
Well, under the...
Yes, but not under the underlying conduct under the taxing power.
Right. That's right. That is eliminated. The only consequence here is tax. There is no other sanction for not obtaining it. I would then like to turn to the final question about the Anti-Injunction Act. And just to go right to your questions there, Judge Kavanaugh, obviously in the nitty-gritty of this technical interpretation of the statute, it is very different than the constitutional analysis of the taxing authority. We're talking about the terminology that Congress used, and we understand that tax penalties are sometimes treated as taxes under the code, but Congress did not do that for the minimum coverage provision. And it's a difficult reading. Obviously, we now think this is the better reading, and it can be read against the backdrop of the fact that if this was not challenged, there would be millions of insurance.
What did you say was difficult reading? I didn't hear that. Something was difficult.
I think this is a difficult interpretation, as I think my colleagues effort before.
Her interpretation is difficult?
No, to parse through all the language of the tax code and all the language
I don't think
of the
Affordable
Care Act. Well, let me explain then why I think. When you refer to the assess and collection, Your
Three
Honor.
Three provisions.
Now, assess and collection is talking about how. It's not talking about when. And assess and collection is in the first sentence of 6671A, not the second sentence. The second sentence is an independent sentence that explains
right. That
taxes are deemed to include penalties. Which penalties? The penalties in Chapter 68, not Chapter 48.
So let me just start. Are subchapter B of Chapter 68 penalties covered by the Anti-Injunction Act?
Yes.
Okay.
Because of the second sentence.
I understand.
Sentence.
I got the because.
Okay.
That's a yes. And then it says Chapter 48, which is where the Affordable Care Act is. It says the penalty for not having health insurance shall be assessed and collected in the same manner as the penalty in subchapter B of Chapter 68. How can it be assessed, but especially collected, in the same manner as the Chapter 68 penalty if it's not insulated from the pre-enforcement suit? The IRS won't be able to get the money in the same way that they can get the Chapter 68 penalties.
Because assessment and collection goes to what the IRS does, is a very specific term of art.
Right.
When you're talking about the Anti-Injunction Act, you're telling what courts can do. The assessment and collection is about how you do it.
Courts can't entertain suits for the purpose of restraining, by the way, it uses the same two words, assessment or collection of taxes.
That's right. It's not saying how you assess and collect. You say whether it's going to happen at all and when. That is different. And that is why there are two different
sentences. Don't think when is part of in the same manner as?
No, okay. I don't. No, Your Honor, not at all. And I think as you read those provisions together, it becomes clear as they're not. The IRS is doing the how. The court is doing the when. We also
the how going to be much different if it's you have to deal with a pre-enforcement suit as opposed to collecting the tax. That's how you'll collect it now and then have to deal with a refund suit in a different court. Isn't that a change in the how?
No, because the assessment and collection is what the IRS is doing, and they have their same procedures that they would go through when they are assessing and collecting the tax. That is different than when the timing for a challenge can be brought, which is what the Anti-Injunction Act goes to.
Well, do I understand you correctly that under your interpretation, the Anti-Injunction Act doesn't bar our hearing this case, but it would bar, let us say, a case brought in the future, assuming this was constitutional, if someone objected to the assessment or the tax, the penalty, on the grounds that they had some individual claim?
That wouldn't necessarily.
Could they bring a pre-enforcement action?
They likely could under this interpretation of what Congress did. And I just, I think.
So then no one would be stopped under the Anti-Injunction Act from contesting any penalty under this statute.
Well, certainly there would be exhaustion.
Long before it was assessed.
There would certainly be questions about ripeness and exhaustion that would arise.
I'm
in
talking
that
about
situation.
The Anti-Injunction Act.
Yes. So the Anti-Injunction would not apply. There'd be other questions about ripeness and exhaustion. I want to make two other statutes.
Wait, say that again? The Anti-Injunction, I'm not sure what your answer is to Judge Silverman.
The Anti-Injunction Act would not be what would bar those other pre-enforcement suits under this particular provision of the code. And there's two other statutory textual framework that I think support this also, Your Honor. There are other provisions in the Affordable Care Act, including one that is in the tax code that expressly refer to Subtitle F, which Subtitle F, as you know, includes Chapter 68, but not Chapter 48.
Right.
That is Affordable Care Act 6301. It was enacted as 4377 of the code, and certainly that shows that Congress would know how to do it if that's what they meant here, and the reference here being assessment and collection to the first sentence of 6671A, not to the second sentence. And that second sentence I want to come back to. If everything was covered by the first sentence, you wouldn't have need the second sentence. The second sentence is what says that taxes are deemed to include penalties, but only penalties that are in chapter 68, the
subchapter B.
I'm sorry, let me.
That's what I read, and that's why I assumed it was limited to penalties. Yeah. Under,
you haven't 6671, read it. You haven't read it yet, have you?
6671A, no.
Read it, please.
The first sentence says the following: the penalties and liabilities provided by this subchapter shall be paid upon notice and demand by the Secretary and shall be assessed and collected in the same manner as taxes. Except as otherwise provided, any reference in this title to tax imposed by this title shall be deemed also refer to the penalties and liabilities provided by this subchapter. If our penalties and liabilities were already encompassed by the assessed and collected language, that second sentence would serve no purpose.
Yeah, and if it were just Chapter 48 where this penalty was, be easy. It's the cross-reference to 68. When I said it wasn't hard to read the cross-reference, I didn't mean to imply that it's not close. I think it's a extraordinarily close question of statutory interpretation.
And I do have to say it does not refer, however, to the specific statutory provision, but
You had a broader argument on the AIA, I think, that at least in other courts, that Congress somehow intended for these to be heard quickly. Are you still advancing that argument?
It is certainly reasonable to look at what type of provision you're talking about, and when you're interpreting the statutory language to determine against what backdrop Congress is acting and whether or not this interpretation makes sense. And we do think part of the reason this is the better reading is that Congress enacted the minimum coverage provision as part and parcel of the community rating, the guarantee issue. And there will be millions of private insurance transactions in the next 4 years before this effective date and before a refund action could be brought. So
the people who worked on this, very experienced members of the Senate Finance and Ways and Means Committee, very experienced staffers, very familiar with the tax code and the Anti-Injunction Act, lots of exceptions in there. The cross-reference to Chapter 68, as I read it and pieced it together, was a desire not to use the T word in Chapter 48, and so use the cross-reference to 68. 68, in turn, makes clear it's enforced in the same manner as taxes, kind of, as I said earlier, the A equals B and B equals C, rather than saying the penalty is a tax, which people, for understandable reasons, wanted to avoid saying directly.
But just, I think, three things then, Your Honor. It's in the tax code. It's going to be on your tax form. It is right there under the taxing authority. But moreover, Your Honor, the cross-reference was to assess and collection. It was to the general chapter. It was not to the specific provision of that second sentence, yeah, which does the lifting. If it had been a reference to that second sentence.
No, I think your argument on in the same manner as is a challenging one, and I don't know how it comes out.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. If there's nothing further.
Thank you. Mr. White, we'll give you 5 minutes.
As in other cases that are pending with the health care law, the government, again, has not set forth any limiting principles that are judicially administered, as the 11th Circuit pointed. Under their logic, they can require us to get long-term care health insurance, buy an Apple, and even admitted in the Northern District of Florida case that they can require you to buy a General Motors car. Even though they say the health care market is unique, we're all involved in it, okay, a lot of people aren't involved in it, okay. There are other markets out there where everyone's involved in it. You're involved in the food market. You're definitely involved in the death market, right? You can die and have an extraordinary debt and cost shift to all types of people. But that doesn't then mean Congress can now impose a requirement that everyone has to have, you know, $200,000 of life insurance, so there's no cost shifting. Uniqueness of the healthcare market, as pointed out by the 11th Circuit in its case, is a distraction here. Because uniqueness then is just different circumstances, not a constitutional limitation that's judicially administered.
Your line between activity and inactivity. What about in Gonzales? Suppose in that situation I inherit a house and there are drugs in the house and I am illegally in possession under that statute, right?
Correct.
I didn't do a thing.
You bought the house.
Activity.
By buying the house.
No, I bought the house.
Right.
Oh, I see.
You
bought, I bought the house and there happened to be drugs in the house, so that's my activity.
No. What your activity then is triggered is the fact that you happen to buy a house that has illegal drugs in it. Then it's your obligation to act to remove illegal drugs because Congress had prohibited the illegal drugs.
Suppose I don't even know the drugs are there.
But once you, then you have not engaged in economic activity, because the economic activity is defined in Raich is the manufacture, distribution, or consumption. Okay, you're not consuming, you're not distributing.
But it included possession, and possession could be a situation where you do nothing.
Possession, though, under the facts of Raich, where these people were using the drugs for municipal reasons, they just
you're right about that. I'm just stretching the statute out.
And I think at the point of, if you walk into your brand new home and you go into the basement for the first time and you see stockpiled 15 kilos of crack cocaine,
and you do nothing.
Okay, you do nothing. Well, when the DEA kicks in your front door with a search warrant, you're gonna have a lot of explaining to do. Okay, why you didn't do it?
The activity is the explanation?
No, the activity would be, you need to get rid of the drugs, okay? Unless you want... The mandate is, but it's only because there's a prohibition. There's a difference. Congress, you know, it's because it's the reverse of everything here, right? Congress can prohibit, Congress can do, but...
Did Raich refer to possession?
The statute did.
The statute may have, but Raich, the definition of economics...
In defining economics, it didn't refer to possession.
Economics was just manufacturing, distributing, consuming. It didn't talk about possessing, because obviously you'd possess if you have to consume or distribute and do another thing. It's subsumed within there.
Why is Judge Sutton wrong in saying that no one's inactive when deciding how to pay for health care? You have self-insurance, private insurance are two forms of addressing the same risk. You're not inactive. You've got to make a decision. If you decide to act to self-insure, that is action.
But
I don't get it. Just so you understand my question, for the reasons he gave, I don't get this distinction in any event, but I think he makes the larger point that if we're going to play your word game, you are taking action if you decide to self-insure.
But self-insurance is something, you know, like Walmart does. They stockpile a whole bunch of money for lawsuits and things like that. People who do not have insurance are not necessarily planning on getting sick, are not necessarily stockpiling money for that thing. That is more of, would be like self-financing. So I go to the doctor, I have a $1,000 bill. I would say to him, okay, look, I'll pay you $10 a month until it's paid off. I can do something like that. It's not as though I just put aside the $1,000. A lot of people don't even think about getting sick. And we talked before, the main group that they're targeting are the young and the stupid. Never think they're going to get sick. They don't have health insurance. They don't think anything is going to happen. They don't think they're going to hit by a bus. They're going to get struck by lightning. Nothing. Okay? It's that group. You have the people who are just going about life hunky-dory. They don't think about it. But when you talk about cost shifting here for health care, they're working under the piling of inferences. It's you're going to get sick. You don't have insurance. You go to the doctor. You get treated. You can't pay the doctor, and you can't either come up with a payment plan or charity or other people kicking in money, and then you're cost shifting. Not everyone who does not have insurance cost shifts. And again, the individual mandate has exempted out large numbers who do cost shift. 19% of the cost shifting is done by illegal aliens who are exempted out. If I may go quickly to Wickard, and this also ties in with your questions about race, if I just have the 1 second, is the question always, before you get to the rational basis, is what is Congress regulating? Is it economic activity? We only get to the rational basis after we answer the first question. The rational basis deals with the substantial effect on the economy.
Rational basis goes to the intrastate being aggregated, correct?
Correct, but only after you say Congress has the
right,
power in the first place.
Go to the first question.
And then also with Wickard
But the power to regulate the interstate market here, which is conceded.
But
as Justice Scalia, you're asking where's the principle, and I think it's fair, the Supreme Court doesn't decide all possible hypotheticals in advance. What they did was what Justice Scalia did, said there are bottom line principles that govern us here. And if there are intrastate activities that will impact on the area that Congress may regulate in interstate commerce, that's permissible.
Right. But he started off by answering the first question, yes. Here, the question is, can Congress require people to buy a private product, health care, when they don't want to? That has to be answered before you get to, can Congress now use the means? And what Justice Scalia is looking at, he's working under the assumption that Congress has the power to make this closed regulatory scheme.
I'm talking about a due process question, not a Commerce Clause question.
With all due respect, I am laying...
With or without due respect, what do you want to say?
I'll meet you outside after when you don't have your robot.
Bunch of what?
But also on the Wickard thing, there's a difference between putting limitations on someone that has a consequence where he or she may have to buy a product, just like we go back to the closed regulatory system. Congress is outlawing drugs. It's putting drug dealers into a different line of work. It's not mandating the line of work they have. And with regard to the Anti-Injunction Act, there's a difference by me saying A is collected the same as B does not mean that B is the same as A. Just like my garbage and my recycling. Wait, just as my garbage and my recycling are collected in the same manner, that doesn't make my garbage the same as my recycling. And under Section 68B, it says it's assessed and collected the same way. But that doesn't make a Chapter 48 penalty the same as a Chapter 68 penalty. And just think of my garbage and recycling.
I'll be thinking about that one.
Counsel, what about, do you take the position the mandate is independent, legally independent of the penalty?
You can never get to the penalty without the mandate. The mandate is...
No, that's not my question. Is the mandate, it goes to the issue whether a refusal to engage in, to comply with the mandate is unlawful or in some way criticizable even, or as the government is suggesting, that the only implication is the penalty.
No, because it's not an option. It's like I use my example of the speed limit. I have to go 70 miles an hour. I don't have the option. It's a consequence of me failing to abide by a law.
Well, now, wait a minute. If you go more than 70 miles an hour when the speed limit is 70 miles an hour, well, you're engaged in unlawful activity.
In that particular case, yes.
Is this true here?
I don't think it's a crime not to have the insurance.
It's unlawful.
It's unlawful in the term of you are violating a mandatory statement by Congress that you shall get the minimum essential coverage. Okay? You have to comply with that. You don't have the option to say...
It's not a question of whether it's criminal. It's whether there's a legal obligation.
Right, it's legal obligation.
Independent of the penalty.
Correct.
It's a legal obligation enforced by the penalty.
Correct.
Correct?
Yes. Because it says shall, and if you don't do that, then there's the consequence. And in closing, just want to say again, this court has the obligation to make sure that Congress is not overstepping its constitutional powers and to impose meaningful limits. The individual mandate exceeds Congress's Article I power, and it is invalid law, as Justice Ginsburg said recently in the Bond case, quote, a law beyond the power of Congress for any reason is no law at all. The individual mandate is a law that is beyond power of the Article I power of Congress. We request you rule it unconstitutional, reverse the final decision of the district court, and remand this case for further proceedings. And thank you very much for all your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. White and Ms. Brinkman, for excellent arguments in a extremely challenging set of issues. I also want to thank, on behalf of the panel, all the amici who provided very helpful amicus briefs, and we will take a 10-minute break before hearing the next case.